Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraic Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. Tonight, just with me, Neil Denny, because Padraic Reedy, who was supposed to be co-hosting tonight, has got an injury, so unfortunately he's not been able to make it. He's at home with a poorly foot. Our guest tonight is Dan Hind. Dan Hind was a publisher for 10 years. In 2009, he left the industry to develop a programme of media reform centred around public commissioning, whose journalism has appeared in The Guardian, The New Scientist, Lobster and The Times Literary Supplement. His first book, The Threat to Reason, which we'll talk about a little later, was published by Verso in 2007. And his latest book, which we're going to talk about right now, is The Return of the Public. So, Dan, welcome to Little Atoms.
Well, thank you very much.
I think we should possibly talk about quite an obvious question. What do we mean by the public?
Well, this is in a sense the thing that drove the writing of the book. It's a concept that is extremely confused. It is very difficult to get a clear sense of what we mean by the public, partly because of the different ways in which it's used. We talk about the public sector and the private sector with a very specific sense. We talk about public and private in our personal lives in another sense. And we talk about the public and the private in a slightly more refined sense. And what I found when I started looking at the concept was that there are really two very important families of legitimating ideas that revolve around different notions of the public or different ways of talking about the public interest in particular. And those two ideas really come down to notions of public service on the one hand and the notion that market forces can be left alone to deliver public goods. So in the classic formulation of Adam Smith, private vices lead to public benefit. And if you think about how we justify our current arrangements, overwhelmingly they will be justified in terms either of a notion of public service, a sense that there are qualified people who are in a position to make reasoned judgments about what's thinkable, except essentially what's possible, what would constitute a kind of utopianism, and what would constitute a kind of practical and sensible way of dealing with things. And around the other pole of these ideas is, as I say, this notion that private actors operating in open and free markets will behave in such a way that the public good will emerge, and that's the best of all possible worlds. And the moment you start to have interference by well-meaning public servants, you're on the road, as Hayek said, you're on the road to serfdom. And what I was interested in doing really in the book was excavating an older notion of the public, a notion of the public that's become very much more obscure than it once was. And this is really the idea that the citizen body, constituted as a public, are the essential animating force, if you like, in society. And this is a model that we associate with classical republicanism. It's revived in the period around the English Civil War. It informs the construction of America in very interesting ways, which I think has a great deal to tell us about our current arrangements. So in answer to your question, part of the point of the book is to say we don't really know what we mean when we talk about the public, and the way that we talk about the public is in many senses hemmed in by assumptions about, as I say, the notion of enlightened public servants who can arbitrate on matters of public concern and can somehow come to some sensible compromise, and the notion that it's all down to operators in free markets who will deliver these public benefits. And I think those are the two dominant ideas of the public if we stop to think about them.
Well, let's talk a little bit perhaps then about why now for this book. We're in the middle of a the mother of all financial crashes caused by, you know, an unregulated financial industry and wealthy bankers. And yet, you know, the government are in the midst of a massive programme of cuts that's going to cut public spending. So what we might colloquially call the public is going to be paying for the deficit, basically. The government's accountability, or the, you know, the sort of ruling class's accountability, and at the same time that public sort of faith in the government are pretty much at an all-time low. So, you know, this obviously is quite a timely time to call for the sort of return of the public.
Well, it was very interesting in the aftermath of the crash, where you had a sort of a timid re-emergence, if you like, of the public service tradition in economics. So you had people like Krugman and Stiglitz who were saying, neoliberalism has failed, we've got to go back to this model that Keynes kind of innovates, where technically minded experts can make judgments about the running of the economy, and they do so on the basis of as it were an enlightened understanding of political economy. And that's really the sort of the founding notion, I think, that goes into the creation of the post-war settlement in Britain and into the American response to depression in the 30s.
We're very much talking about the idea of experts.
It's experts again, and what's interesting about the coalition's response has been to say, no, we're not going back down the Keynesian road. We're not going down the road of public servants who are qualified to decide. We're going down the road of unleashing the animal vigour of the market. So within the context of a debate that seemed to be opening up when the private lending and credit institutions collapse, there's a debate opening up about maybe we should have the public servant back. Maybe we should have these people back who regulate banks properly and take a reasoned view about what kinds of freedom are unacceptable. And the response of the right in this country, and indeed the Tea Party in the United States in a different way, has been to say, no, there wasn't enough in the way of market forces. We need more market forces. And they've been relying on a whole set of, as it were, emotional repertoires to get this idea across. So a crisis that's been caused by, as I say, a failure in the private sector banking industry is now being laid at the door of welfare cheats and the most vulnerable in society in some way, who are taking too much in housing benefit and so on. So there's been a very carefully thought through attempt to shift the way that we think about this crisis and shift it away from it being a crisis in the private economy and shifting it into the realm, as it were, of the moral and moving into the world of resentment against middle class transfers to the poor. And they've got away with it because they largely control the climate of opinion. One of the themes that comes out in the book is that the public servants never really understood why they were allowed a seat at the table. If you look at the move into administration by people like J.K. Galbraith, mm-hmm. and so on in the 1930s, and indeed the movement into government of people, you know, who were following Keynesian ideas in Britain, they didn't appreciate fully the extent to which they were essentially riding on the back of a very, very well organised and very motivated labour movement in both countries. So it's really the push that comes from mass movements that enables public servants to do their thing where they're rational and they're appreciated for what they do. You know, someone once said the difference between an economist who becomes the head of the Federal Reserve and an economist who writes letters to his local newspaper is the extent to which his ideas are useful to the governing powers.
So let's perhaps talk about then where that idea got lost along the way, because a more obvious image that people have now of the sort of ruling classes is something that you talk about in the book, you know, the idea of, you know, Peter Mandelson holidaying on the yacht of a Russian oligarch along with, you know, Tory party funders and sort of politicians.
I mean, yeah. I mean, going back to this idea of these sort of two families of legitimating ideas, when you look at ruling class support for the notions of the free market is overwhelming something that's a good thing for other people. And if you talk to any serious businessmen, they hate free markets. They're not interested in competition. They want monopoly. And the name of the game is to achieve monopoly in some way and to hold on to it as long as you can. So entrepreneurs love to hear themselves praised as being risk takers and so on, but they're in the business of minimizing risk. And if they can do that through, as it were, gaming the political process, then of course they will do so. And one of the awkward facts about recent Russian history has been the sense that the way that you get rich is by controlling the state. And the reality of ruling class control is that you talk about free markets, but you use the operations of the state to ensure that the markets are structured in such a way that you win. So competition's great as long as you make sure that you're going to win. And you know, going back to why it is that Republican notions of an activist public are eclipsed, I think part of the story is that in Britain in particular, you have something like a Republican ruling class after the removal of James II. But it's a Republican ruling class that doesn't advertise the fact. So the aristocracy organised in Parliament used the institution of the state crucially to change the property regime. They enclose the commons in Britain, for example, and they're able to generate enormous surpluses through impoverishing very large sections of society, and then they use these surpluses for foreign adventures. Now, in doing that, they're acting, as it were, as a classical public. They're sitting down, they're figuring out what works, and they're lying and cheating and stealing to get what they want. But they're doing it as it were, an absence of publicity. So what the public see is a monarchy, and they see the principles of aristocratic governance and so on. They don't really see the movements behind the figures on stage. So it's not quite the case that Republican public has vanished. In some senses, that's what we mean when we talk about the Davos class, or we talk about the directorate of people who run large companies and who are active in government and so on. These people, to some extent, constitute a public. And in much the same way that the Houses of Parliament didn't used to publicise their proceedings, overwhelmingly these people meet at places like Davos, where they act, as it were, as a parliament, but they don't share their kind of resolutions with the people who it'll overwhelmingly affect. There's a much more complicated story about why the general population hasn't really been encouraged to think in these terms, but I think that the time is ripe. You know, the idea that we can rely on public servants unaided, and the idea that we can rely on sort of undiluted market forces, have both really collapsed as legitimating stories, it seems to me. They just don't really work. And we can talk a bit about that, if you like. But there is another way of thinking about publicity, mm-hmm. is another way of thinking about what it means to be a public agent, if you like, which is much older, and which I think is much more interesting, essentially. And it connects with intuitively, it seems to me, with a sense of what it is to be a fully rounded human being.
Let's perhaps talk a little bit about that when we talk about sort of the get to the sort of what can be done point. But I want to talk about the sort of ways in which these received wisdoms have been manipulated, and we'll get on to the media. But first of all, I want to talk about this. It even seems like a very weird thing to sort of describe, but there is an industry, there is a whole industry that you can work in lots of multivarious ways, which is called public relations, which is all about, you know, the idea of manipulating public opinion. I mean, let's perhaps talk about the rise of how this came about. I mean, why do we even have PR people?
I mean, the history of it is very interesting. In a sense, public relations is born out of the realisation by a number of people working in the entertainment industry, Edward Bernays most famously, the realization in the First World War in the United States of what was possible if you combine the techniques of, as it were, theatrical promotion with the resources of the state. And so Bernays and Lippmann and others, who were the early popularizers of the notion of the need for a public relations industry, and it's important to stress, I think, that they had a moral account of why it was necessary, which was profoundly anti-democratic and very old. I mean, they sound a lot like Plato when they talk about the public and the need for a directorate of experts who will manage public opinion in a scientific way and so on. You know, so how does that come about? Well, you know, overwhelmingly, the story is one, it seems to me, of the need to manage a democratic population in the midst of domination of the economy by relatively small numbers of very, very large and very powerful actors, whether it's the financial sector or the corporate sector more generally. There is a growing fear certainly from the 1890s onwards and probably earlier in the United States that democracy is going to be used to challenge the, as it were, the corporate settlement, this condominium of Wall Street and the corporate form that you find in America, is desperately frightened about what the progressive movement's going to do, what the campaigns against the interests are going to do. And essentially, what, as it were, the last the remnants of the Republican spirit in the United States, what they might do. And by Republican, obviously, I don't talk necessarily about the Republican Party, but this notion that the public should control the state, which continues as a figure in public relations, is an object of profound real fear for the corporate and financial elite. And public relations is part of the solution to that problem, I think.
Let's move on to perhaps how media operates in this as well, then, because obviously we're now in a position where most of the media that the vast majority of people consume is produced by very, you know, very few huge media conglomerates who obviously have a vested interest in a certain message being portrayed. So, you know, people, the information that people are able to get is very, very filtered.
Well, I think it's an interesting story. I mean, in the book, I'm interested and I'm wary of the notion that we are, as it were, living in with false consciousness in some simple way. I think that plenty of people, in fact, most people, have a fairly sceptical approach to what they read in the newspapers. And I don't think that's true. That's not just true of a sort of educated elite. I think more generally, people are aware that, they put that in the papers because people will buy papers and so on. So there's a sense in which the information they're getting, they're kind of wary of. And people are perfectly capable of coming up with an alternative story about the world on the basis of their own experience. So the notion of, as it were, total control that one might sort of be tempted to think about is a mistake. Where I think the media institutions are much more effective is really in managing our perceptions of each other. So I might think, oh, well, I figured it all out. I know that the media are this kind of corporate system and they're not to be trusted. But everyone else is lost in this realm of false consciousness, and therefore there's not really much that can be done about it. And I think that the idea that comes across endlessly in the major media that pretty much everything's fine, and if you're not fine with it, there's something wrong with you, is a very effective kind of story that's told. And it doesn't have to be centrally directed. You know, the advertiser isn't setting out to make you feel bad. He's setting out to make you buy toothpaste. If he makes you feel bad on the way, that's a byproduct. So the notion that dissent is in some way dysfunctional, I think, is very successfully conveyed through the normal operations of the media business. But if you look at, you know, if you look at popular attitudes, or, you know, you look at public opinion reports, it's quite common that you'll see the population of the United States say, you know, 3% of Americans think that CEOs can be trusted. Well, that doesn't seem to me a society in the grip of false consciousness. They're pretty clear about what's going on.
You're listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Dan Hine. So, Dan, I want to bring in your previous book as well, the Threat to Reason, but I think probably the best way to do it is if we sort of try and include it in the same discussion about the Return of the Public. And at the end of the Return of the Public, you sort of talk about ways in which we could reform the media.
Yeah.
I'll let you take that up, really. Let's talk about
The way I think it connects to the previous book is, in a sense, the first book is an attempt to set out what would seem to me to be an individual project for enlightenment. So what kinds of priorities would you set for yourself if you were thinking, actually, you know, let's take Kant seriously, let's think about what it would mean to dare to know, and what sort of order of priorities would that establish? And it was very much centred, really, on the notion of the sort of the individual character trying to make sense of the world, and it's, in some senses, it's an individualistic story. And in the second book, I'm much more interested in looking at the institutional conditions in which that kind of project would make sense. One of the things that I think is problematic about current conditions is that the more you know about the detail of how the fix is put in, as it were, mm-hmm. the less easy it is, it seems to me, to sort of communicate in a calm and socially acceptable way about it. So there's a sense in which political education becomes isolating, and a lot of people say, oh, the politicians, they're all in it for what they can get, and they pretty much stop at that point because they don't really want to go down the road of being the guy who rants about stuff, right? So rather than put it all on the shoulders of the individual and say it's up to you to figure out exactly how the military-industrial complex works or how the financial sector works and so on, in the second book, I'm interested in saying, you know what, there are things we can do at the level of the institution that make that kind of enlightened activity less harmful. And crucially in that is this notion of public commissioning. The crucial point in the book is to say, if we take seriously the idea that the population should organise itself as the animating principle in what is generally known, and if we take seriously the idea that in a democracy, public opinion forms itself in a reflexive way, then we need to kind of create some distance against both market forces models of how we organise the media and public service models. And we need to say that actually, as organised publics, we need to be able to allocate funds for research. It's all very well for me to have my enlightenment project and to pursue it in isolation, and bully for me. Much better for us collectively to be able to direct resources in ways that seem to us to make sense. And that doesn't, you know, none of us then direct that. You know, we all have I'll use a word that will make you nervous here, we have a homeopathic amount of power, if you like. We have, you know, we have a little atom of power that we can use to direct research and we can use to publicise the consequences of that research. And if we do that, then the things that both public servants and market forces are very bad at describing, I think overwhelmingly political economy is a problem, overwhelmingly the sort of mystique of war and peace is a problem. Those very things that are impossible, very difficult to talk about in a serious way in the existing media forms, become accessible. And that's really what I'm interested in doing, saying how do you make an Enlightenment project possible that's also a communal project, that's a collective project.
What about within that? It's a really, you know, inspiring idea, but there has to be some sort of, not necessarily gatekeepers, but some sort of threshold of quality that sort of people can rely on. And we've talked about, yeah, the problem with the sort of mainstream media is that what if one's going to interpret what you're hearing from, you know, Fox News or something, you've got to pick out all of the sort of, you know, the ruling class elements. And I think there is other media. There's other media you can watch. There's the sort of NPR stuff, alternative media, and things like sort of Media Lens and Indie Media and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think what you then have with that is the same problem, in that the line between the serious media that those people are producing and the conspiracy theorists is a little blurred.
Yep.
So then you have to pick that out. So you're still in the same position where you're, you know, for whatever the truth is, if you're looking for the truth within a certain amount of media, you still have a certain interpretation.
You know, I think that as an individual, as an isolated individual, trying to piece together a story about how things are, which goes against the sort of the general descriptions that we're exposed to, is a very hazardous process, you know. And, you know, Kant said, you know, when first we learn to think for ourselves, we are bound to stumble. And I think a lot of what people do when they start sort of latching on to all explaining theories and so on is that they're almost, they're getting kind of, it's like the narcosis of new perspectives. I mean, it is sort of bewildering and exciting to think, oh, maybe it's all this or maybe it's all that, and I won't go into the details of what people think it all is. But again, there's two questions, it seems to me, in what you were saying. I mean, how do you manage quality control? The way that you manage it is by the operations of a democratic vote. In the end, you can only really be an advocate of public commissioning if you think that the people who are motivated to care about the general field of what's known, the general field of publicity, are going to be more interested in promoting true ideas than untrue ideas. And if you don't think that, if you think that people are intrinsically wrong-headed, then this model of media reform isn't for you. I won't pretend that it won't throw up all kinds of wacky ideas, but the process by which these ideas reach daylight is the same process by which these ideas could be destroyed.
So what within that, what is the difference between true and popular?
Well, there is, well, this, that, you know, we're on the edge of very deep waters philosophically at that point.
But you're talking about almost the truth emerging through a sort of democratic process.
Yes, yeah. And I'm not arguing for this as a complete replacement for other forms of media. You would have commercial media, and you would have public service media of a more traditional sort. But do we want to have a mechanism by which things that everyone or large numbers of people are concerned about has some means of entering the public sphere where it can be criticised in the normal way? Or are we happy with the existing model? Now, going back to your point, popular ideas are often wrong. And popular ideas popular ideas proliferate, above all, in the commercial space. People will go with ideas that work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of the backstory for conspiracism, if you like, is that it's a genre that people appreciate. I mean, that people like it, and so there's a sense in which market forces give some ventilation to some very pernicious ideas. Again, I think a notion of the public space as being a free for all where ideas can be presented and claims can be made that are factual claims, but then they can also be challenged, offers us a very different mechanism for establishing truth and falsity. And as I say, it goes back to what we think the public is, or what the public would be capable of being under these conditions. I don't think people are that committed to ideas that they will hold on to them in the face of all the evidence. I just, you know, put me down as a child of the Enlightenment. I just don't think that's the case. And it'd be interesting to find out how many people feel similarly.
Well, let's talk then perhaps about if this, you know, sort of media reform came to pass in any sort of form, how do you think that would then change the what are the issues that's sort of bedevils politics, I think, at the minute is and you talk about this in the book, is the idea that, you know, politicians are judged on things like sort of personality and character, you know, rather than deeds. I mean, how would the sort of low esteem in which politics is held currently by the public be changed, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the first things, not to answer your question in an outrageous way, but one of the first things that it would do is increase the number of people who work as investigative journalists. Mm-hmm. The numbers of people who work full-time as investigative journalists is like 75 or 100 people at the moment. And the proposals that I set out in the book, which are notional proposals, for the kinds of money we're talking about, which is like £120 million a year, you could have 3,000 full-time investigative journalists. And that would change the economy of information in the political sphere. You just have more people who were engaging in substantive issues. And they would be asking questions that, as I say, are very difficult to ask in the current system. And that would, I think, that would encourage or compel the political classes into, as it were, a publicly defensible account of what they're doing, rather than into a way of operating that relies on being privately appealing. You know, Tony Blair is a very likeable guy, and Barack Obama is a very likeable guy. They're operating in an environment which is really leached of a lot of the ideas that are deeply pertinent to most people. And public commissioning would force them, I think, to engage with those.
We're out of time, so we're going to have to end there. So we've been talking about Dan Hynes' book, The Return of the Public, which is out now from Verso. So, Dan, thank you for speaking to us today.
Absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.